Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome. I hope you're well and you've had a really good week. It's been incredible weather here in the UK, really hard to believe for September. And I hope whatever you've been doing, you're all good. I've been incredibly busy with the Sober Club, of course, and also my Platinum Awards coming up. I've got such great guests lined up for you today. You're going to love listening to Mark from the brand Liars. I'm sure many of you now are aware of Liars because they really are a global brand. And I'll let Mark tell you all about their incredible drinks. And also, so pleased to be able to chat with Mandy Manners and Kate Bailey from Love Sober. The book is called Love Yourself Sober, and it's aimed at kind of mums and parents. And wow, what a topic. I'm so thrilled that this book has come out, because I so wish I'd had this book when my kids were young. It's exactly what's needed to just break this pattern, interrupt this ridiculous kind of mummy drinking culture that we have going on. So I'm so pleased I'll be able to bring you their interview. Just wanted to mention a couple of things. One is that our event at Champneys, our retreat, is going ahead on the 3rd and 4th of October, and there could be one or two places left. You'd need to check. It's obviously very small because of social distancing, but do check out. There could be a couple of spaces left, so now would be your time. It's self-care and sobriety. And if you go to thesoberclub.com and click on events, you can click through to that. It's probably best to ring them up if you did want to book, rather than try and do it through the website at this point. Do have a look at that. Also, you can check the show notes, of course. Also, I must tell you about the amazing little thing that happened in the week. Such a tiny thing, but you know, since reading Catherine Gray's book, The Unexpected Joy of the Ordinary, I'm looking out for things more than I ever used to. So outside my bedroom window, I have this kind of little mini balcony thing, and it wasn't particularly well designed in that we put some pot plants there to grow some plants, but kind of hadn't realised that we wouldn't be able to get at them easily to tend to them without kind of hanging from the balcony. So the bottom line is that they're not tended to, and they're sort of slightly crappy pots that have got lots of sort of weeds and, you know, dried stuff in it, dried sticks. So they're not particularly attractive. However, I woke up the other day, opened the curtains, and I just couldn't believe it. There was this sunflower, like an actual tall sunflower that had grown out of one of these pots. How amazing. I've got absolutely no idea how the seeds even got there, because trust me, that I wouldn't have thought about that one. But there it is, just absolutely standing there, shining at the sun. Amazing. You see, you just have to learn, don't you, to look for the beauty in the... even in the crap. It's the only way. And when you've ditched the booze, trust me, you can do more of that. You really can. You really can notice stuff where you didn't necessarily before. Anyways, without further ado, let me introduce you to the gals.
I'm so thrilled to be able to chat to Kate and Mandy from Love Sober. And if you're watching the video, this amazing book looks so gorgeous. And we're going to be talking all about the new book. Mandy, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your story, and then we'll ask Kate about hers, and then we'll get into stuff about the great new book.
Yeah. Well, I think my story's pretty normal, I'd say. Well, I don't know, but I started drinking about 14, kind of average 90s teenager, Alka-Pops, and, you know, and kind of in the rave scene and really kind of into music and going to festivals. I used to work at Glastonbury, so quite a kind of hedonistic, I suppose, time. I guess we were a bit kind of bored of the status quo. So there was quite a lot of testing the boundaries at that time, wasn't there? And there was kind of that, you know, sort of icons of rebellion and Ladette movement, and I was very much kind of felt like that, and you know, no sort of warning signs. I mean, I guess maybe kind of anxiety and mental health was kind of always there in the background, but I never kind of, you know, understood that, you know, there was something there until motherhood, really. And after I moved to France when I was 20, not very good with time to date, when I was 25, and I was pregnant with my daughter. So I'd kind of, I think that was, I was always very much like, right, something's not working, like, let's run away, basically. So I, like, I grew up in a small town, you know, wanted something different. So I ran away and went to uni in Brighton, and then we were partying too hard, and, you know, everything was, so I was like, right, let's move to France, because my partner at the time was French. And then I was like, right, I want to stop partying, let's have a baby, that kind of thing, solutions based. And yeah, so I had my daughter when I was 26, and then 19 months later had my son, living in France. And I guess that's when my drinking kind of shifted. I was quite lonely. I went back to work and was kind of achieving quite successfully in my job very quickly. So I was working as a professor in a university, and so I had this kind of career all of a sudden, and that kind of attached me back to being me. But then, like, I was a mum and just was getting extremely stressed, didn't have any support, didn't know how to ask for help, felt quite sort of stubborn, I suppose, in that, or just that I had this idea that to be a good feminist I had to do everything, you know. And and so, yeah, I kind of ended up in burnout with quite sort of severe depression, and at that time I sort of went to see my doctor, and I started doing CBT therapy, and that's when I kind of started realizing that drinking was part of the problem. I had had quite a lot of trauma when I was younger, sort of, you know, when I was kind of 18, 19, and hadn't really ever addressed that. And I, you know, that was kind of coming up, especially as a mum to a little girl. I was kind of really struggling with hypervigilance and trying to manage that sort of state. So I wasn't sleeping a lot either. And so, yeah, so I was drinking, I guess, kind of got what we call classic grey area, you know, like binging. And, you know, I would sort of be putting a lot of rules around it, trying to manage it, trying to keep it in my life, especially in my head, you know, being in France, I wanted to be the chic kind of woman that drank every now and again. But it was really kind of making me unhappy, and I was getting more and more dangerous. You know, I was kind of blacking out more, having more accidents, falling over, not remembering, lots of shame. And that was back in 2013. That was the first time I reached out for help, and I joined Soberistas, started blogging on there. By kind of midway through 2014, I stopped for a year. Got a lot better, mental health was a lot better, I was feeling great. So that classic thing was like, oh, well, moderate. So I went back to drinking just after about a year. I think I had in my head, like, if I can do a year, I don't have a problem. I think there was I only sort of realized that recently. You know, there was a real subconscious thing of like, yeah, if I can prove that I don't have a problem.
Yeah.
Then I went back and forth for about 2.5 years, which was hell. Just that kind of like, it doesn't look that bad, but it's not making me happy. Until finally I quit in August 2017.
Yeah.
Got my dates. Yeah. So that's me, I suppose, in a nutshell.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Well, we'll talk about, you know, some of the ins and outs of that in a while. Kate, what about you?
Hiya. Hi, Jamie. Yeah, I'm a little bit older than Man. So when she was doing her teen thing, I was sort of doing my 20s thing in London. And I'd kind of progressed from sort of drinking snake bite and black, you know, down the poly in the mosh pit, you know, in the 80s. And then suddenly it was like my whole life was sponsored by Blossom Hill. It was like watching Friends, coming home, I was working in the media, and I was having a whale of a time sort of on the outside. But inside, I think something that had stemmed for me again, I'm going to sort of make some kind of TV reference, which was when I was a teenager. My mum had divorced my dad and married my stepfather. And it was that Hyacinth Bouquet on Keeping Up Appearances was on the TV. That very sort of, you know, net curtains twitching and everyone trying to look kind of respectable, but behind the scenes, people not being very happy. And I think, again, that kind of summed up my trajectory through my life. It's like it all looked fine, like a duck on water. And underneath, I felt like I was just really paddling for my life in terms of feeling quite anxious, quite disconnected, recovering from hangovers, trying to prove that I was good enough at work. You know, like that sort of, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't want to go back to my 20s. I really wouldn't, you know. Or I'd like to go back if I had my head on now. And then you'd really boss it. But, you know, that's not how it is it? So, again, I think I was doing that sort of acceptable, you know, binge drinking and it all kind of looking okay. And that carried on into my 30s, really. But there was a bit of, I don't know, I hear this on sober forums sometimes where, and especially as coaches now, we work with values where I kind of had one set of values of that I was really into health, really into fitness, quite into kind of spirituality, you know, like went to yoga and really sort of aspired to be that kind of clean living, kind of lovely goddess type person. And then I just kind of go and get wankered, excuse my French, and then just be nicking everybody's fags a minute later. And there was just like this disconnect between these, like Jekyll and Hyde, you know, and that caused me a great deal of confusion. And I think it was this disconnect in me that gradually, as I got older and hopefully a bit wiser, I just, it was like the cracks really started to show, the hangovers got worse, the disconnect got worse. And then add into the mix sort of then becoming a mum. And I think I, like Mandy said, you know, like you have, I feel like I've got a real every woman's story in that thankfully I didn't have a rock bottom. I still had a roof over my head. I was, you know, I was happily married to my husband, you know, again, keeping up appearances, it all looked okay. But then underneath, I went through that identity crisis of being a mum. I just hadn't got a clue who I was. I also just thought, oh, well, I've done most of my pregnancy sober. So hooray, I haven't got a problem. And now I'm going to enter motherhood and I'm just going to be this really good mum. And it's all fixed.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, okay, that's really not happened. And then that was even worse because you've got the sleepless nights. I remember when I had my son, I lived in a flat in Brighton, well, down on Hove seafront, and we had a pub sort of kind of a stone's throw away. And I remember vividly having the baby and my husband was working late nights in London. And I suddenly realised I just couldn't leave the flat and I could hear people in the pub garden. And I just couldn't get out. And I was really, I just think there was one of those moments where I was like, oh my God. And I remember drinking a beer and smoking out of the fire escape window kind of thing. And then the baby was in another room and I was just like, okay, this isn't feeling good. This isn't fun. This isn't me having a good time. This is just all conflicting. And so I did seek help. In the end, I went to my doctor. And she was great. But what I found is I often, because I was like that, again, that sort of grey area binge drinker, sort of just about like putting a lot of rules around my units, but kind of only a bit into that hazardous, harmful thing, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, couple of bottles of wine a week. It was like I went for permission to stop. But because the medical profession are just not like, you know, they're not informed, a lot of them.
Yeah.
I was given permission to continue time and time again. Every time I went knocking on doors saying, this is not feeling good for me, this is affecting my mental health, they'd go, oh well, you know, here's a wheel, and then if you have a gin, that's like one unit. And I think I've got this etched on my brain, like literally this is like all I do is count bloody units. But I couldn't sort of say that or articulate it at the time. So it was really sort of motherhood as well, like Nan said, that just it started to take a darker turn. And as I became more isolated, I was leaning on it more and more for that kind of loneliness, stress relief, a bit of my time, a bit of that, okay, I'm back to me, the children have gone to bed and now I'm back to me. You know, all of that stuff. And then I'd look outside and I'd say, can I stop? And then the doctor, you know, our counsellor would say, oh, it's fine, don't worry about it. And I'd look outside and I'd see a mug with mummy juice on it and I'd get the mirrored back, don't worry about it. So again, my insides and the outsides didn't match in any way and it was very confusing. And I think in the end, I used to do that, like wake up at three and Google, am I an alcoholic kind of thing. And then I found in 2013, I did it and I found Soberista's website. And instead of looking terrifying, it had a flower on it and it was like, love your life in control. And I was like, oh, okay. So I blogged for the first time. I'd never blogged, never went, Insta wasn't a thing, didn't go on Facebook. And I thought, okay, well, give it a go, press send. I don't know if anything works. And in the morning, I woke up and I had 8 replies from people just saying, other women saying, like, you know, we get you. My blog was just very much like, you know, I've never lost my driving license, and, you know, but this isn't working. And all of these voices came back and said, yeah, me too. Yeah. And that was the first time I'd ever had that echoed back at me, ever, ever, ever. And I stopped that night, having never made it past 3 weeks apart from pregnancy, for a year, that was it. Like manned, being that grey area drinker, and one of almost like the first of the kind of out of the stable in those very early years, there wasn't really that ongoing support. And I think in my head, I'd set a year as well. Yeah. So I went back and then a couple of years later stopped. So my sober day now, I stopped in 2016, so I'm 4 years alcohol free now. I'm feeling, you know, so much better.
Yeah, fantastic. And you know, I love the fact there's so much we can talk about, but I really love the fact that, well, I love your title, you know, Love Yourself Sober. It's just perfect. And I love the fact that you've made this book, you know, as it says on the tin, a self-care guide to alcohol free living for busy mothers. So what is it with this thing of motherhood and drinking? You know, I just, because as you guys know, I've spoken about it a lot, it was exactly the same for me, that my drinking ramped up. I never had a rock bottom either, but my drinking definitely, definitely ramped up when the kids were young. And I thought that was my self-care. You know, we didn't use words like self-care when my kids were young, but I thought that was me treating myself. The treat was to go and, you know, go and drink, to get away from the kids for a bit, you know, to have someone look after the kids and to have that well-earned treat. So, you know, I don't know which of you want to answer this, but when did this, maybe we should take it even back a step. And I know Claire Pooley, author of The Sober Diaries, often talks about, I think she spoke in her TED talk about how if you go way back to kind of, I don't know, 50s, 60s, women per se didn't really drink. It's only when we got that kind of baby sham marketing coming in that women started ramping up in the drinking. And then you mentioned, Kate, you know, well, both of you mentioned the kind of the hedonistic days when you're drinking because you're in the media or your advertising career, whatever the hell it is you're doing. But I have no idea what this question is, by the way. I'm just rambling. But, you know, you'll be able to do something with it. So it's a kind of two-part thing. It's what the hell is going on with women starting drinking, and specifically what is this thing with motherhood?
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely a kind of, you know, a question about, you know, for women and a feminist question, which I think Kate can probably talk about in a moment. But in terms of the kind of where it's come from, I mean, you're absolutely right. There was, you know, it, if you look into the history of kind of alcohol marketing, or there was a gap in the market, essentially, you know, that women weren't drinking. I mean, I guess you can argue that there was the kind of, you know, Valium, or there was other things going on for women of how they were kind of numbing out. And it is part of that thing of trying to cope with not having the support that's needed. And kind of what happened very much, I think, in the kind of, you know, the 80s, 90s kind of generation of women, it was like all of a sudden, you know, we'd fought for our rights to work, we'd fought for our rights to vote, you know, we were suddenly allowed, you know, a place at the table with men to have a career. And that part of that was, you know, you had to drink like a man, you know, it's like, right, if we're, you know, even ladette culture, I mean, it's yeah. like you had to be like a man to be able to be accepted within that realm. And a lot of it was, you know, kind of heavily boozy and extremely dangerous for women in those areas, you know, and that's kind of linked to the Me Too kind of huge sort of explosion of women talking about experiences they had in their careers and that kind of link of what was going on there, because it was extremely boozy, it was extremely trying to get your voice heard and trying to sort of get a place at the table. But then obviously, you know, something else happened and then social media did start, and so there was that kind of backlash, just like, right, we're out in the world, and then it was like, you know, we're going to do it all, and it was like, we don't have the support, this is really hard, but we can't now say we don't want to work, because we do want to work, but we don't have the support. So then it was like, right, let's be honest about it. So there was this kind of honest parenting of people on social media going, I'm really struggling. And it was such a relief, because it was like, oh, thank goodness, you know, and there was a real camaraderie around mums at that time. And part of that was like having a glass of wine at the end of the day. And it was kind of celebratory of just like, we made it, woo, you know, and I really felt like that. And I was so lonely, and, you know, the breakdown of kind of family units and not living next to your parents, and because of kind of economic reasons, a lot of people move out from like their like communities in the city to the suburbs. And both Kate and I did that, you know, Kate was in Brighton, I was in England, I moved to France, she moved out, you know, to the suburbs. And then all of a sudden you're on your own. And so you're linking with people through social media. And then there was this kind of really dark turn of all of a sudden, you know, social media marketing, which is kind of shared by peer-to-peer, doesn't have the same kind of, you know, legislation around it. All of a sudden you were getting influencers drinking gin, or, you know, people drinking wine, and there was mummy's wine juice, and then all this kind of, you know, getting wine glasses with kind of the limit of normal, you know, a good night now, mummy's drink, you know, like
that marketing around it. Horrible.
Yeah. And not only sort of talking about, you know, having a glass of wine celebratory with your friends, it was drink this to numb out and self-medicate the stress of being a parent. And that's why we felt so passionate to write a book for mums, because it's like, this is not this, we get it, like we get you're super stressed out, but what we should be fighting for is rights, you know, like we should be fighting for us to get support, and we should be looking at, we absolutely can, but let's have flexible hours for work and you know, support mums, not go shut them down and keep them quiet and just, you know, drink, because it's an addictive drug essentially, you know. So
it's so true. I mean, sorry
just one more thing while I think about it. And also, you know, in terms of mental health, you know, mums are super super vulnerable, you know, like postnatal depression, the levels of kind of stress that mums have, you know, the change, as we've talked about, that transition, you know, all of that is kind of the perfect storm for developing a problematic relationship with alcohol. And rather than getting help and being supported and saying like, what do you need, mums, you know, we're being sold something to kind of keep the problem in the kitchen, you know, as it was with Valiums for mums in the 60s. So yeah, there's definitely something going on with mums, which is why we feel so passionate about it, really.
I mean, I definitely want to talk more about the mental health aspect, but Kate, did you want to add anything? I know there's a, you know, a section in the book called Is Alcohol a Feminist Issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mandy's covered most of it, really. But I think that there's the other side of it that I would add in terms of the whole, you know, the kind of evolution of going, hang on a minute, I smell a rat, you know, and kind of going, oh, but then what do I need? And that's for a real key, because it's like, okay, well, we can smell a rat and we can go, actually, that's not working. And then we've got to also be really careful that we're not judgy about it, because you don't want mums kind of going, but that was just my one thing and now you're going to take that away. So it's like, okay, we need a, you know, and I know that you work with this, Janie, as well, but you know, you need a toolkit, you need self-care strategies, you need, you know, at the end of the day, like you say, you might have an ongoing battle. Like you might find you wake up and you feel fine. I'm not going to drink tonight, no problem. And then you have to skip lunch hour because you've got to leave at 5 o'clock. Because if you don't, you're not going to make it. And yeah. Your colleagues are tutting and rolling their eyes because you're first out of the door at five. God forbid you should actually leave on time. Then you get caught in traffic. So then the nursery are rolling their eyes and you get home and you're so frazzled. And actually, so you need a hell of a lot of stuff at that point. Like you say, we need flexible working. We need, you know, maybe we need some kind of financial support so that if during those key times you don't both have to work to put a roof over your head. That's just my opinion. But also at that point you need your own toolkit, don't you? And you at that point, you what you're looking to do is autonomic nervous system regulation. You're actually looking to, you need to de-stress, and again that takes a little bit of time and it takes some education and some support. So it's, I guess it's about that, really kind of making that point really clear that it's not about judging and it's not about being perfect. It's kind of going, actually, what do I really need? You know, because I don't want to just put a band-aid over it in the form of a glass of wine, which is then going to turn into two and is then going to make me feel horrendous the next day, yeah. You know, and lower my mental health. So it's really calling a spade, really.
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, as I say, there's so much we could talk about here. And I know both you guys have done a huge amount of work, you know, with mums around the whole area of sort of mental health and anxiety and being really honest and open about it. I've heard, you know, you speak very openly about your own experiences. Again, I'm probably just going to ramble here because I don't even know what the question is. But one thing I still can't get my head around really is why there hasn't been more of a link made between alcohol and drinking too much. And I'm constantly told by members of my women in my sober club who will say to me, well, exactly as you said, Kate, you know, they rock up to a GP and they're given permission to continue. I certainly was when, you know, years ago, I remember asking a GP, you know, am I drinking too much? It was a very tentative cry for help. And am I drinking too much? And then she said, no, sounds completely normal. Have an alcohol-free day. Yeah, you know, hate that. But anyway, people, you know, kind of women have told me that they rock up to a GP talking about very specific issues with anxiety. Some are perimenopausal, some are menopausal, and they go in and they talk about the anxiety, they talk about the depression. And in every case of the women who've spoken to me, they're given, sometimes they're given antidepressants, very often they're given antidepressants, sometimes they're given HRT. None of them have ever been asked about their drinking. So I've no idea what the question is or who wants to take it, but what is going on there?
Well, yeah, I'm quite interested in this. We were talking to someone about this recently, weren't we? I can't remember who it was, but it was sort of that kind of signposting within the NHS in the UK. And you either get signposted down a mental health route or you get kind of signposted down a kind of an addictions route. And they don't really talk, they're starting to talk to each other. And we just recently did a thing with ICAD, didn't we? Like a presentation to medical professionals to try to raise awareness within that. So Mandy found a brilliant report as well. Is it the 2017 report by a mental health charity?
2006, yeah.
Was it 2006? But it just hadn't made the press.
Yeah, I mean,
it hadn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things going on there. I mean, it's quite. We live in an alcohol-centric kind of culture, so you know, it's kind of educating at every level, you know. And so, if you're talking to someone that drinks themselves, it's not going to be on their radar that's the issue. There still is. I mean, we've been doing a bit of radio because of the book, you know, and both of us had that kind of question of like, you know, A, why don't you just have one? Isn't it really boring?
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, teetotalers are the most hated people in Britain. It's just like, whoa, okay. And I mean, yeah, the report was the Mental Health Foundation. I think it was 2006. And I burst into tears when I read it because it was just like, this is it. Like, I can't believe it, you know. And it was talking about how kind of government funding should be going into, you know, why we're self-medicating with alcohol and that it's the number one stress reliever that people self-medicate with in the UK, and not put all the money into antisocial behavior orders and, you know, sort of criminalization. Yeah. That's, you know, that's not the issue here. The issue here is mental health. It's maybe it's not fashionable, you know, maybe it's not politically helpful for certain, for the government to kind of put their money, that I know obviously they have big relationships with you know, alcohol funding. Brands, yeah. You know, yeah. So there's a lot of that sort of stuff going on. I mean, it is changing, and I do think, but it's also that thing, this was another thing that when we were researching for the book, you know, the first study that was done on female women and alcohol was in 1990, you know, the official study, because before we were sort of seen as unstable subjects for testing because we have periods and we have hormones. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all the kind of studies were done on men. It was just like, well, we'll just sort of blanket say, right, it's the same. And actually we don't have, you know, we don't have a, I don't know what it's called, but we don't have an enzyme in the blood that breaks down alcohol in the same way as men. So we actually don't, you know, alcohol does something different to us than it does to men, but we only started to find that out in the 1990s. So, you know, hopefully, and us being open and doing the things that we do, and you as well, Janie, you know, hopefully this will continue to change. And more women in higher power jobs will, you know, be able to say, look, actually, you know, my workforce have hormones. Yeah. And perimenopause and menopause, and all that needs to be part of the well-being plan of our employees, not just kind of like just pretend it doesn't exist. Mm. I mean, it doesn't mean that we can't do things very well. We absolutely can. But when we always say, it's like respect the ebb to boss the flow, you know, like women can be super, super, super highly kind of productive, that then sometimes you need a down day too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think as well, you know, and I know that you agree with this, Janie, but there's this kind of also, whilst it, you know, we tackle the kind of normative drinking culture in terms of calling BS on it, whilst also tackling the stereotypes and stigmas around sobriety and actually saying, you know, it's much better, you know, it was the perfect ruse, wasn't it? Mm. It's the perfect ruse to just say it only is a problem of a few people and the rest is just normal behavior.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it was like, that is genius. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's starting, you know, it is starting to change. And it was, I mean, this year was, it was said sobriety was one of the biggest health trends, wasn't it? And,
yeah.
You know, and it's not to make it, I always see it as like a 360, because I know there are is sort of divisions within the sober community of people going, yeah, but it's got, you know, it's heavyweight, it's real, and it destroys life. Yes, it does. So, but we've got to also catch people earlier on the alcohol use disorder and make it palatable, positive, attainable. You know, it's changing the whole of the conversation, is it? And I think that's where, from our experiences, it was like, okay, well, we were on that. Thankfully, we hadn't got the whole host of a lot of social problems. And we hadn't got, I know for myself, I wasn't physically dependent. I don't think you were, Mams, although I know you sometimes.
No, it's so true. You don't have to be at rock bottom, do you, to benefit from ditching the booze? Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's kind of, and like I said, you know, one of the reasons, yeah, you know, I set up Love Sober as a blog, like I sort of came out of behind the sort of, you know, the curtain of soberistas and went, okay, I'm going to dare to go a bit public with this. And that allowed Mandy to find me. And the reason it was called Love Sober is it's because I know I felt very passionately about it. And then when Mandy and I started talking, we both felt very passionate about the fact that we love frickin' sober. Yeah, we love
exactly.
Let's shout about it. Let's come out of the shadows and you know, the podcast was Mandy's idea, and we, you know, we started chatting about it, and we got very excited about all the kind of positive psychology, the science of happiness, all of the kind of neuroscientific and evolutionary theories, because we were having a bit of a nerd out about all of the stuff that you can do to make yourself feel brilliant.
Yeah.
And so that is part of it as well. It's like, well, what happens next? What happens after you get sober? You want to stay sober, and then you want to love sober.
Exactly.
And we really feel.
I think that's what I love about this is, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, the loving sober, because once you're there, it is amazing. You know, as my TED talk said, you know, sobriety rocks. But also yeah. your clever spin for your title on loving yourself sober, because. Yeah. This actually tracks back to the fact that most of us start this thing because our self-esteem is so goddamn low, you know, so there is so much need for the self-care, you know, that we're talking about. So, you know, the book is brilliant from that respect. I must just ask you one other question, because I know it's going to come up for I could ask you, we could be here for hours, but I know people will pick up on the fact that both of you said that you were sober for a year, and then, you know, then that voice comes in, doesn't it, saying, oh, you got this now, you're good, you know, you can have one. What's your thinking around that now that you know all you know, and what do you sort of advise people in the book? I know you've got a chapter about staying sober, you know, going deeper, staying sober. What's your top tip for anyone who is you know, maybe even coming up to that year, and thinking, oh, maybe I'm good?
What would you like to say now?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you pointed out the key thing, which I think was part of the puzzle for us, which was certainly for me, it was self-care and self-esteem, and the fact that I was, you know, I was using muscle power, essentially, you know. And I think there's a part, you know, you've got your kind of, in coaching terms, your move away from goals. So it's like, ah, oh, it's all really bad, and it's really kind of, so I need to stop this behavior, you know, and that takes you so far. But I hadn't really realized that I needed those kind of move towards goals too. So I needed to like throw it a bit further and all of us, and then go, right, but what do I really want out of life? And how does sobriety, you know, attached to that. So I kind of got so far, and then I got lost, and I was like, but I don't have any friends, and I don't know how to live, and what if my husband and I don't survive, and it all just got really hard. And at that point I moved as well, and so meeting new people was just like, I can't be sober, like I didn't have the identity. So I think for me it certainly was that I needed friends and community, which I didn't have at that point. And so yeah, I think have a look at what else do you need kind of in the long term. Is it sustainability, isn't it? So it's like, what do you need to make it sustainable? Is it that you need a community and friends and people that you can rely on, or is it that you need to do some forgiveness and actually maybe do some therapy, or, you know, really kind of sort of close the box on the pain and find some strategies for that? And for Kate, I think it was something slightly different.
For me it was definitely that. I think, again, at that time it was like I'd set that milestone of a year, and I didn't really have a plan afterwards. And there weren't that many peers around that at that time, so I do think there was that need for peer support and community, like Mandy said, the sort of coaching element, because we both trained as coaches. And I think it's that what next question, and it's like, okay, we need to set, like you said, a goal. And for me it was like, very much I needed the toolkit, I needed all of that stuff of like, I needed to work with my values, like what's important to me, and I needed to tether sobriety to that and clear up a few kind of old things I had hanging around about it. I needed self-care toolkit and to manage my nervous system. Boundaries I've written down. I needed to discover boundaries, and I needed to find joy. And I'm going to do, if it's all right, I need to do a little bit of a plug here, because it is valuable here, because you said, what's your tip? And what we've been working really, really hard at the last few months is beta launching a 3-month group coaching program, which is called Loving Sober. And it's that it's much more like not about getting sober, but it's all of that self-development that people end up seeming to stumble upon. So it's like that next bit. Yeah. So, and we're going to start that in November.
Great.
So sorry, I've hobby horsed another little plug on that.
It's perfectly okay. Just before we finish up, you know, and I know there'll be people listening, young kids and are going through all of these things that we've all kind of discussed, but it will feel hard for them. You know, it will feel really hard. So let's just quick fire. Can we maybe just each of you just quick fire some amazing benefits of being a sober mum, particularly? You know, let's just sort of love bomb some love people listening. Let's love bomb them with some benefits of being a sober mum. Talk over each other. Go for it.
Okay. So patience. I'm so much more patient with my kids. Fun. I was controlling my drinking, so I was controlling everything else around me. And when I stopped drinking, all of a sudden I was much more fun. No shame. Safety. Like if they're sick in the night, I'm there. I can drive them to hospital.
That was massive.
That makes me feel really, really proud of myself. Emotional, like well-being. I know so much about how to manage my own emotions, so I can teach them that. They're proud of me. They have a choice. Like my husband drinks, I don't drink. They're going to grow up going, well, mummy doesn't, papa does. I'll think about it and see how it feels. And that feels really great.
Yeah.
Go, Kate.
And I feel like, okay, I suppose my major one is that I feel like I'm not wasting a single moment. I'm not rushing through everything to get away from them at the end of the day. I've got much more of a sort of a balance so that, and I just get those moments, you know, I don't, you know, when you don't miss them. And I really, really love that. And I feel that sort of present to enjoy the good bits. And I feel, you know, it's not always easy. So that's not a bright, sparkly thing, but I got resilience now to deal with the troublesome stuff. And I just honestly, sobriety just throws up. I think it's like those, I'll use another metaphor, like those prospectors in the States, you know, when they went panning for gold and you kind of sift through and more and more and more, and you might go through a bit of a dirty patch where you're like, oh, this feels like a bit muddy, and then you'll get more gold come up. And honestly, it's just the best.
Yeah,
it's the best thing.
Amazing.
And it keeps getting better.
Great. So thank you so much, guys. And the book is really great. And you've got so many, you know, it's very realistic and honest and everything's covered in here. So, you know, well done on just a fantastic book and really giving people very specific. I like the way it's laid out. It's beautifully laid out. So it's
easy, isn't it?
It's very easy. You can dip in, you know, you can dip in. Oh, actually, I'm just feeling a bit crap today. And I'm just going to dip in and read that bit, you know, and that's really fantastic. So yeah, well done on a great book. And just remind us where we can find more about your work.
Well, everything is on our website, so www.lovesober.com, and the book is available from all places where you can buy.
Brilliant. All right, well, we'll have you back some other time, definitely.
Yeah, thanks so much, Janie.
Thanks, guys.
You're listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast with Janie Lee Grace. And as promised, let's check out Liars with Mark.
Mark, how you doing?
I'm well, Janie. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's so lovely to chat to you. I mean, what a brand. Where do we start with your incredible Liars brand? I mean, literally, you've just kind of taken this market and rocked it and knocked it for six. It's just amazing. Where do we start then? Tell us a bit about your background and how all of this came about, and particularly why it was your passion.
Sure. So look, my background, I'm from beverage marketing. I started my career with Coca-Cola in what seems like several lifetimes ago now. Then moved to the agency side of the industry. After doing a few years of that, founded my own agency with a co-founder. That's called Kinetic in Sydney, Australia. And over the last 10 years, we've built a number of businesses all in that sort of marketing services vertical, looking after major consumer goods businesses from around the world. And then after 6 or 7 years of working on other people's stuff, we said, you know, we should probably give our own product a try. And one of the things that we'd been observing was this incredible health and lifestyle macro trend that seems to ignore borders and ignore age groups and is pushing changes in human consumption of food and beverage around the world that we see, and changes in behavior. So we put our attention on that sort of trend and said, what could we deliver in this space that might have some appeal to, you know, people around the world? And we landed on this idea to do a non-alcoholic spirit. And this was back in 2015, 2016, and recruited a whole bunch of friends into the project, including a good friend of mine who's a master sommelier, David Murphy. And I told him, hey, I need some help with getting the flavors right on a project. He said, what project's that? And I told him it's non-alcoholic spirits. And he laughed and he laughed and he laughed and he said, there's no such thing. And I said, well, do you mind coming to Germany with me and working on the product? And he says, of course not, as long as we can stop by the Moselle. So we ended up engineering our products over the course of a sort of 2 to 3 year development period. Was launched in July of last year, and we're now available in 13 countries, soon to be over 30 by the end of this calendar year. Wow. The team's 35 people, it'll soon be over 50. And it's been an extraordinarily and blisteringly fast sort of growth for our business, and as well as the category more broadly.
Mm. And tell us about the name, because there's a lovely story behind it.
Yeah, the it's you can probably hear in my accent, of course, I'm Australian. So I'm not quite Steve Irwin Australian accent, but it is, I do have some telltale signs. But myself and my co-founder, Carl, we're both from Queensland, but the name Liars comes from the Australian lyrebird. So I guess an analog for the UK is the mockingbird. So it can recreate or mimic the bird song of any bird that it hears in its natural environment. It's part of its defense as well as its mating mechanism. It can also mimic human sounds, so chainsaws and mobile phones and car alarms. There's a lovely little David Attenborough segment on YouTube if you want to look up the lyrebird. So for us, being a brand of 13 non-alcoholic spirits that were designed to mimic the flavor, the bouquet, and the mouthfeel of the originals, we thought that that would be a lovely little mascot. So the lyrebird sits at the top of our brand, and you can see that in the neck label of our product. But in order to name the brand, we shortened it. Instead of calling it Lyrebirds, we called it Liars. And we thought that was a cheeky little thing to call a brand that was based on mimicry. And we like the fact that people who consume the product might have a little secret with the bartender. So we wanted people to ask for, you know, the drink that they've always known and loved, like given that you're a Brit, I'm sure you've had a G&T or two in your time. So we wanted people to ask for a Liars G&T or a Liars Old Fashioned or a Liars Negroni. And that would be the language we were hoping that would become synonymous with the non-alcoholic category. Liars version of their favourite drink.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's been amazing is that you have even managed to be right up there competing and winning against conventional alcohol. I loved hearing that story. Yeah. That, again, I mean, it's just so cool.
Yeah, that's a real, and thank you. you know, being cheeky Australians, we try and ignore rules wherever possible. So yeah, we entered a number of our products into a whole bunch of global blind tasting spirits competitions. And the one that sort of broke through was it's called the SOMCON, and the judging panel's 8 sommeliers and 4 industry journalists. And it was a blind tasting, and a number of our products ended up picking up medals. And our vermouth, which is our aperitif rosso, actually won a double gold versus alcoholic counterparts. So for me and for the broader team, that's incredible validation with regards to our product development, that we've got it exactly right. So we're honored and delighted by those. And we've added that to what is now a stable of more than, I think it's 59 medals received in global spirits competitions, including the London International earlier in the year.
Amazing. Tell us about all the different flavors then, because that's another thing that's unique about you guys. You know, you didn't just bring out the gin, as it were. Yeah. You've got a whole bunch of amazing, because I think this can be one of the hardest things, actually, because because when I a while ago I had a kind of a little party, and quite a long while ago now, obviously, back in February, and invited some a friend who always drinks alcohol, but his drink is kind of whiskey, and so you know, the kind of the alcohol-free gins and stuff just wouldn't cut it for him, really. So I love the fact that you've broadened it. Tell us about some of the different flavors that you have then.
Sure. I guess I'll take a step back and go, why do we have so many
flavors? Yeah, of course.
That's probably the more interesting question. For us, we wanted to provide a system that we could replace the back of the bar. And for people who make drinks at home, or for mixologists that professionally make drinks in a beautiful bar environment, we wanted to give them the option to do exactly what they've always done, but in order to remove alcohol from their beverage, simply reach for a different bottle. So that was our sort of gold standard for the development of the liquid. And the 13 that we've landed on, they actually recreate 42 of the world's top 50 cocktails and 9 out of the 10 most popular mixed at home drinks. So for us, being that, sorry, there's a boxer over there. Unfortunately, the boxer doesn't have a mute. So with those in developed, it was to provide the maximum amount of utility to people in order for them to eliminate alcohol from their consumption experience at the time, regardless of what their favorite drink happened to be. So that's why we did so many. And the ones that we do have, all of the stalwarts are there. There's gin, of course. We do have a bourbon. We have 3 rums, white, spiced, and dark cane. They're very important for the entire body of tiki-style cocktail making, of course, made famous by Trader Joe. At Trader Joe's. And then, of course, we have 2 vermouths. We have a dry and a Rosso, which are, you know, I've had mixologists on our team tell us they're the salt and pepper of cocktails, and you'll find them in almost everything. And then we have our liqueurs. We have a coffee liqueur, which is similar to a Tia Maria or a Kahlua. We have an amaretto, or we call it amaretti. And that's, of course, the famous Italian almond liqueur. We have a absinthe, of course, which is my never-ending joke on the world that I could create a non-alcoholic absinthe. And we have a triple sec, or we call it an orange sec as well, which is one of those things that's found in enormous amounts of cocktails that there needed to be a non-alcoholic version of to recreate some very famous and very high volume ones like the Cosmopolitan or a Mai Tai, for example. Mm.
Amazing. Fantastic. So what would you recommend then if someone's kind of brand new to all of this, you know, and they're just thinking, oh my goodness, well, where shall I start? Which one shall I pick first? And what drink shall I make? Do you have any top tips?
Yeah, for sure. So look at what you consume presently. If you're a bourbon and cola person, or if you're a gin and tonic person, buy the corresponding non-alcoholic spirit and then mix it up the way that you normally would. And you know, that's a really interesting introduction into the brand. And then you can compare non-alcoholic spirits versus the real deal. If the non-alcoholic spirit and that taste and that occasion and that moment is replacing the place where alcohol would normally live, and you still want all of those things but without the alcohol, that's a big tick. And then what we've noticed is when people have that moment, they then start to get curious. And I think our brand's been responsible for creation of an entire generation of at-home mixologists, where people get more and more curious about what the flavors are that they can combine, and what is mixology, and how do I go from being a home cook into being a liquid chef? And away you go. So I'd say start at what you know, and then broaden out your experience from there.
Great. And just a word about the ABV. I know that there's always so much confusion because the labeling is different in different countries, but just explain to us what Liars is, and for anyone who's brand new to it, what this kind of 0.5% thingy means.
Sure. So look, alcohol is a natural part of life. Wherever you combine yeast and a source of carbohydrate, you're going to find alcohol. There's some on your skin right now, Janie, where yeast from the atmosphere has landed on your skin and it's eating dead skin cells.
Nice. Gross,
but this is the world we live in. So other common places that you'll find alcohol is in a loaf of bread. there's alcohol there. You'll find it in orange juice when you buy it from the supermarket, and you'll also find it in kombucha. So there's a global standard for something considered a non-alcoholic drink, and that's 0.5% ABV. So that's a World Trade Organization standard. And then you've also got different interpretations of that in a number of different markets. But for most markets in the world, 0.5% ABV or less is considered a non-alcoholic beverage. Mm. So the entire Liars range falls below that magical 0.5% ABV mark, as do most non-alcoholic spirits on the market out there. They all have trace amounts of alcohol due to their manufacturing process. But as I understand it from some people that are very well qualified in gastroenterology and nutrition, what's interesting is that your stomach tends to destroy any of these trace amounts of alcohol before it crosses into your bloodstream and turns it into sugars. So, that's
excellent. Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. It's good to have it explained again. So what are your hopes for the brand? I mean, obviously, as you say, the growth has been absolutely amazing. It's so well received. People love it. What's going to be for the future? I mean, I'm guessing as more and more bars start to open up again, hopefully we're going to find it in more bars in the UK as well.
Yeah. So look, we think it's already in close to 1,000 bars in the United Kingdom.
Oh, great.
Which is brilliant. So the team there has done an incredible job. But our ambition, we're very, very quickly working on being available globally. So like, a bottle of Coca-Cola or a Mars bar you want, or McDonald's, you want to be able to have a consistent product available in all global locations. And that's really important so we can then build a global brand, which is undoubtedly our ambition. In order to do that, there's enormous number of challenges. We need to comply the product. There's different legislative requirements around making a non-alcoholic beverage product in all of the different markets. We need to translate all of our labels, which has been incredibly fun. And I had a magical moment seeing our first back label in Dutch, which was really cool. It's not something that I expected to see, but it's one of those interesting moments where you go, oh, wow, we really are doing this. And then, of course, setting up the manufacturing all the global locations in order to support the local markets, and then recruiting team members to sell into all the local markets. So there's an enormous amount of work to do. And I'm very blessed that I've got a team that's made the work incredibly fun, and they're executing really, really well. But once we have that global distribution footprint, then it's all about increasing volume. And for that, the consumers are doing that job for us. People out there who are going, it's a Tuesday night, I don't want alcohol in my diet because I'm getting up early for a Wednesday morning gym session, or I have to be sharp for a meeting tomorrow, or I'm just not drinking during the week anymore. People still want their moments of connection with other humans in beautiful environments like a bar. But now they're saying, I still want all of that, but without alcohol. So if we can have, I guess, ubiquitous availability and people can have their drink their way, with or without alcohol, I think we've achieved our objective.
Yeah, totally. Thank you so much, Mark. It's fantastic to chat to you. Don't just give us the website for anyone to find out more info?
For sure. So if you're in the UK, you can find us at liars.co.uk. And if you're listening globally, if you go to liars.co, it will redirect you to your country that you're in presently.
Fantastic. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you, Janie.
Exciting, isn't it? It's so exciting. Just this incredible rise in the choice and the quality of alcohol-free drinks. It's really something special. I've got a very exciting little mini course coming up as well that I've put together with a mixologist. Just really showing you the basics of how to make some fantastic alcohol-free drinks. So looking forward to bringing that to you when we've got it together. Don't forget then the Champneys event, Self-Care and Sobriety, 3rd and 4th of October. If you're listening to this on Friday, I'm going to be at the Wonderment Retreat on Sunday. I'm going to be speaking there on health and well-being and sobriety, of course. And it would be lovely to see you there. Come and say hi if you can make it to that. Chris was our guest on the podcast last week. And of course, as always, please rate and review the show if you enjoy it. Please follow me on social media, on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. It's at Janie Lee Grace. And do check out my show on UK Health Radio as well this week. You can just go to ukhealthradio.com. My show there is called Natural Health and Sobriety. And this week I'm interviewing Andy Coley on NLP. I'm sure you've heard me talk about NLP. I think we've had them on the podcast. But NLP is neuro-linguistic programming, is just such an amazingly helpful tool if you're trying to change your behaviour, which many people listening to this will be, even if it's not ditching the booze. Perhaps you've already done that. But if you're trying to, even just change the way you do certain things, maybe you know that you're quick to anger, or you get upset about things that are really not worth getting upset about, and it can really help you in your personal life. So check out that interview that I did with Andy Coley on NLP. That's on UK Health Radio. And as I say, yeah, follow me on social media. Don't forget to let me know if there's anyone that you'd like me to get on the podcast. I can always give it a go. Got some great guests coming up. I'm so lucky to get these amazing guests. I really am, and I'm super, super grateful for it, I can tell you. Really, really chuffed that I can get these amazing people to come and chat to us. Often people will record some exclusive stuff for the Sober Club as well. So we're building up an amazing library of incredible expertise. So I look forward to seeing you same time next week. Don't forget, if you need to reach out for help, reach out. You know, if you've just ditched the booze, by the way, really important to tell someone. I'm very happy for you to tell me. Just reach out and tell me. You don't have to tell all of your family and friends if that doesn't feel right, but do tell someone. Obviously, it won't have escaped your notice, the news stories this week about the massive increase in drinking due to lockdown. It's been driving me bonkers, actually, because I've seen so many news stories and they're suggesting that people fill in these little quizzes, you know, how much are you drinking, etc., and is it harmful, and all of that. And wouldn't it be great if there was a total spin on that? And instead of just constantly pushing out this fear and making people feel really stressed, how about some positive stories? Like the one I had in the week, my bonus podcast, you know, someone who did manage to crack the booze during lockdown, or a positive approach for people who are reading all this stuff and thinking, oh my God, that is me and I don't know what to do. How about some stories, you know, in the press about the absolute joy of ditching the booze and how incredible life is once you've done it, you know, and then that would inspire people to make a change. Anyways, reach out for help if you need it, is what I'm trying to say. You know, don't suffer in silence. There are so many of us that have been through this. We know what you're going through. So if it's the right time for you to make a change, then absolutely do it now. Look forward to seeing you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.